This is from Flesh and Filigree, the opening. Approaching the Smart Hopman Clinic off Wilshire Boulevard, one is sure to be struck by the estate's breadth and purity of line. The flat, heavy cream stucco of the clinic is the essence of modern architectural propriety, and its modest, substantial proportions already suggest the knowledge, the strict and unassuming skill for which it is renowned. At exactly 10:30, after a few minutes in the outer reception room, a young man was shown into the office of Dr. Frederick Eichner, world's foremost dermatologist. Dr. Eichner, a gray, distinguished man, was at his desk. He looked up into the visitor's face as he entered, then referred once briefly to the suede agenda before him.
Mr. Trevely, I believe?
And saying this, he stood, extending his hand, and indicated a chair drawn near the desk.
Yes, doctor. And allow me to say that I feel privileged to consult you. I know, of course, that you are the outstanding dermatologist of our time.
Dr. Eichner looked at him narrowly, giving the tribute an only slightly personable smile. The patient was a thin man of about 30, an aquiline nose and deep-set eyes. His dark hair was fine, receding slightly at the temples. He was perhaps a handsome man in an anemic and quasi-aristocratic way, Felix Trevely. Dr. Eichner sat quietly, his white drawn hands resting on the desk, his lips parted in an almost weary smile, perhaps only tolerant of his own opening cliché.
And what, Mr. Trevely, seems to be the trouble?
Oh, well, I don't think it's much, really. I have, or rather did have, a certain lesion. A lesion which wouldn't, or at least didn't, close.
I see. And where is this lesion?
Well, at first it was only a pustule.
May I see it?
I should like to give you some particulars, which may facilitate or rather have some bearing on the diagnosis.
Yes. Yes, of course.
As I say, it began about a year ago, simply an irritation at first on the fleshy hinder part of the calf, or the left leg. A small boil, actually a cystic mass, a wen, if you like. Extremely small. I noticed it bathing. And when I got out of the bath, I opened it with a needle, sterilized, of course. I pressed out the secretion and swabbed it down with tincture of methylate, 2% solution.
The young man's eyes met the doctor's as he spoke, and they were sharply blue and perceptive. Across his expression passed the light veil of selflessness that can come to one who recalls and presents details exactly. Opposite now, the doctor sat as weighted, without motion.
And now, a pause in the busy day's activity. As the doctor leaves his little rectory, walks out the marble path covered with aggies, cat's eyes from his youth, down the long path of life, past the elm grove of superstition, and toward the true way. Yes, it's Dr. Whiplash. He's come again to the font of perpetual resurrection to answer some of your questions.
Come in, Doctor.
Dave, what's the first question?
Well, I have a letter here from a gentleman in Flotsam's Mistake, New Jersey. And actually, he's been kind enough to send this letter in on a tape cassette for you, Doctor, so we'll hear his voice and you can use his voice to help you analyze the problem.
It's a novel idea. Leave it to the Japs.
Dr. Whiplash, I am a Japanese businessman. Why have I written before? So I still suffering from the same complaint. I only suffer in the office during the day. At night, I eat out and feel better. And although I can't sleep, it's because of apartment noise. What should I do? Hideo Gump.
Dear Hideo, Your symptoms are shared by people other than your race. To wit, many executives complain to me as suffering from flushing, blushing, running of the mouth, high stool, seat cramps, delayed borgorygmus, and shortness of pants. They also, like you, feel relieved of these symptoms away from the orifice. Can anything be done? Yes. And it should be done now. They, and you, Hideo, are suffering from farmer's lung, usually confined to barns and sponge warehouses. It is attributable to a hybrid fungus, which lodges in the massive air conditioning systems that supply oxygen of sorts to the big buildings that your daddy works in. Although the same bug can be found in home furnaces, it's often rendered ineffectual due to the fact that poor people can't afford air conditioning and are forced to run their furnaces to heat their homes during the summer. This fries the fungus. We doctor people use the word microsporifera funi in referring to this little pest, and literally it can be translated as funny spores. Long known as the cause of Theodore's disease, running sores in athletes' feet. Recently, this microscopic troublemaker has also been blamed in the nasty disease labeled Hartman's palsy, formerly Strassman syndrome, the only cure for which is death. I'll answer any questions, dear friends. Just write me if you still have the strength. Until next week, this is Dr. Whiplash. I'm out for lunch.
Hey, man, you think he's going to make it?
I don't know. He looks pretty sick to me. Hey, I think he's coming around.
He's coming around, folks. He's going to be okay and ready to play Symptom 6 of Beat the Reaper.
Last week, our patient successfully survived the common cold, measles, pneumonia, dengue fever, and the yaws.
And now, the big question. Are you ready to go on? He's ready!
Our topless nurse, Judy, is wheeling our patient into the isolation ward.
Can you hear me in there? Okay, let's shoot him up. Now, patient, you have 10 seconds to tell us what you've got. And beat the Reaper!
I'm shaking, feverish. My hands are all... I'm turning yellow. My God, I've got jaundice!
Jaundice it is! Give it to me! Symptom 6. And now you've reached the final threshold. Here's the question. Are you ready for symptom number 7, longer than any patient has ever survived before?
I want to go home.
Only one way to do that. Doctor, bring in the super shot.
Now, for the first time on Beat the Reaper, we're going for the big disease. The icebox is being unlocked by the president of the Armenian Medical Association, under whose strict supervision these toxins are being administered.
This is it. Doctor, give him that really big disease. Now, patient, can you hear me? You've got 10 seconds to tell us what you've got. And for the last time, beat the Reaper.
I think I feel... I don't know, whatever. Whatever it is, I want to die.
I'm terribly sorry. That's not correct. You didn't beat the Reaper. Doctor, bring the patient out and show the amphitheater audience and all the folks at home just what he's contracted.
According to my careful prosthesis, this man has the plague.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome.
You've got the plague. Well, isn't he a good sport, folks? We'll be back in just a moment. Next patient, but first...
The program, as it developed, was a popular radio and TV quiz show called What's My Disease? and the host, who served as moderator to the panel, introduced its four members as they ceremoniously entered and took up their places at the table. A prominent woman columnist, a professional football coach, an actress, and a professor of logic from the University of Chicago. The panel members were good-naturedly jibed by the moderator, and they smiled a great deal in return. They seldom looked directly at the audience, but rather at the moderator, who assured their constant liaison with the audience by continually turning his glance from them to the panel members and back again, always with a show of serious goodwill. After a moment's distraction, Dr. Eichner retrained his glasses on Treveley and was only vaguely aware of the other developments going forward as the moderator took his place at the end of the table and the first contestant was brought in. The contestant could not be seen, but was wheeled in, completely obscured, in a sort of raised, shrouded cage. "Can you speak?" asked the moderator. "Yes," was the muted reply. "All right, panel." The first questions proceeded rapidly, suggesting by their tone a tediously familiar pattern. "Local or general?" asked the football coach. "Local." "Manifestations visible?" asked the woman columnist. "Oh, yes." "Is it your face?" asked the actress, taking a flyer. "No." A buzzer sounded, tabulating the air, and the moderator made some note of it on his pad and threw a significant glance at the audience. The audience reaction was mixed. A sigh of relief that it wasn't the face mingled with disappointment that the actress, apparently the darling of the panel, had been wrong. She, in turn, seemed good-naturedly abashed, even blushing a little. "Are these manifestations," began the professor, raising his voice to be heard, "above or below the waistline?" "Below." "Is it of the limbs?" he continued. The answer was hesitant. "Yes." "A single limb?" the professor hurried. Hard on the scent of it now, as the moderator beamed knowingly, and the rest of the panel began to smile in anticipation. "Yes." "Is it elephantiasis?" demanded the professor. "Yes." The moderator took up the triumph quickly and with grand good humor. "Yes, it is elephantiasis." And at the same moment, as the shroud was dropped and the contestant revealed to them all, the audience took in its breath as one in a great audible gasp of astonished horror, and then burst into applause for the professor, the contestant, the moderator, and the whole panel. While the latter exchanged informal congratulatory gestures all around, the actress especially animated in showing her modest appreciation of their victory.
"I think we ought to look at this from a military point of view. I mean, supposing the Ruskies stashed away some big bomb, see, and we didn't. When they come out in 100 years, they could take over."
"I agree, Mr. President. In fact, they might even try an immediate sneak attack so they could take over our mineshaft space."
"Yeah, I think it'd be extremely naive of us, Mr. President, to imagine that these new developments are going to cause any change in Soviet expansionist policy. I mean, we must be increasingly on the alert to prevent them from taking over other mineshaft space in order to breed more prodigiously than we do, thus knocking us out through superior numbers when we emerge. Mr. President, we must not allow a mineshaft gap."
"Coal, you say? Coal, did you say, Bill? You talking about coal? Hopefully the line of opposition to the strip mine machine will continue to stiffen. I mean, no one denies the benefits which coal has brought to a developing
right.
nation and a bustling
right.
economy.
True enough.
But if men are to find on this land the necessities of life hundreds of thousands of years from now, we must cure ourselves of the expediency complex."
The coal seam was 75 feet under the earth. At the mouth of the tunnel, the coal seam was raised on an angle facing the mountain. We drove the tunnel 100 feet and met the coal seam and faced up the coal. After we drove the tunnel 20 feet, the rock was hard as flint rock. We had to sharpen our old auger often. Sometimes it would take as much as 2 hours to drill one hole. We were going about 1 foot a day in the tunnel. The air was bad. There was no ventilation. We decided to blast one day and clean the loose rock out the following day. We had to get some air in the tunnel, so we bought several joints of black 2-inch pipe and screwed them together and pushed them into the tunnel. We pulled the blower off the blacksmith shop and attached it to the pipe and placed the blower 3 feet from the ground. All you had to do was turn the crank on the blower and pump air into the tunnel.
He tried to transmit his intellectual experience to his brother workers, but with discouraging results.
Ah, get out of here!
Once in the pit, he attempted to explain to them that the world was round, and he spun about vigorously on his feet to drive home his point. Ah!
He's crazy, Louis.
But the men laughed skeptically and declared that his information was absolutely untrue.
Yeah, follow me. It's absolutely untrue.
George remained isolated in the spring of his expanding universe.
You know, mountains have been removed, and societies and psychologies destroyed, and surface excavations resembling vast moon craters with hundreds of feet of soil, Bill, and rock discarded in the assault to reach the coal have been left in massive piles.
The tipple set out in a little field. It was 40 feet higher than the drift mouth of the coal mine. To overcome gravity, we built a trestle from the coal tipple back to the ground level of the mountain and laid steel track down the trestle.
Bill.
Then we graded a tram road down the mountain to the drift mouth of the mine. We laid steel track down the incline to the drift mouth of the coal mine. We walked back up the mountain to the top of the grade, installed a hoist powered by a 1927 Chevrolet engine. The drive shaft was attached to the hoist. We hooked a steel cable in the mining car, put the old Chevrolet engine in low gear and gave her the gas. The mining car climbed up the incline. When the mining car reached the top, we shut off the gas of the engine.
When I became aware that there were actually moonworms around the rocks, I'm afraid I temporarily lost my resistance, and that's when one of these parasites slipped into my head. They don't want to hurt anybody or anything. They just want to live inside others' heads.
Twice tragedy overtook him. Fanny Henderson, a farm servant who became his wife, died of consumption, leaving him with a young son. George's father was struck in the face by a blast of steam and lost his eyesight. He retired from the pits, and George supported him for the remainder of his life.
You can put me down now, George.
Sending from his own mind to yours, here is Nino Savat with a psychic minute.
Can I say, hello, this is Nino the Mind Boggler with Occult in Your Head. Today, let's get into holes, the most mysterious, importantest, and vaguest subject of them all. The whole earth might be called a hole if you're on the inside looking out, and whole golden cities might be hid at the bottom of a bottomless pit. Even wholesome humans have holes, though we're hardly whole at all. In fact, we're wholly holy, as the Holy Book says in the Book of Holes, chapter 1, and they knew not their holes from an ass on the ground. Holes are positively attractive. Let's go inside one and see. This is a typical hole. Not a hole in the wall, but a hole like a well. Well, what the hell? That's the sun at the center of the earth, and that's where this hole leads to. What a nice warm fire. Next time, I'll think to you about gravity and its opposite, comedy. Till then, this is Nino saying, can I say goodbye?
In a faraway forest. There's a dark, deep well. Near the well, there is grass that is called Sleep Well. In the night to the well comes a big black owl, and he puts some grass into a big black bowl. And he pours in some water from the dark, deep well and prepares a drug with a nice, sweet smell. And he flies to the children and he gives them a drink. And they get very sleepy and begin to wink. If you ask me, my darling, you'll go to the owl, and I'll tell it, Black Owly, be a nice, kind fowl. Give me, please, for my baby, from your drug just a sip, and my baby will drink it, and will sleep.
Mandrake.
Yes, Dad?
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
Well, yeah, I can't say I have, Jack.
Vodka. That's what they drink, isn't it? Never water.
Well, I believe that's what they drink, Jack, yes.
On no account will a commie ever drink water, and not without good reason.
Oh. Yes, I can't quite see what you're getting at, Jack.
Water. That's what I'm getting at, water. Mandrake, water is the source of all life. 7/10 of this earth's surface is water. Why, do you realize that 70% of you is water?
Oh, Lord.
And as human beings, you and I need fresh, pure water to replenish our precious bodily fluids.
Yes.
Are you beginning to understand?
Yes.
Mandrake, have you never wondered why I drink only distilled water or rainwater and only pure grain alcohol?
Well, it did occur to me, Jack, yes.
Have you ever heard of a thing called fluoridation? Fluoridation of water?
Yes, I have heard of that, Jack, yes. Yes.
Well, do you know what it is?
No. No.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
Penis nose.
Did you say penis nose?
Doc.
This is Doc Infermo at the infirmary.
Yeah, I know.
The wells are poisoned.
Of course they are, Doc. You poisoned them.
Well, you made me do it.
That's why they elected me. Shiny, shiny water, remember?
The images of the water are shocking enough.
Would you drink that? People have dumped in this river forever. It's like we're in a cesspool.
My tub, you should see it, it's brown.
And then come the headlines. An American city failed to provide basic protections to its citizens, and now the children of Flint have much higher than normal levels of lead in their blood. Rick Snyder, governor of Michigan, has apologized.
I am sorry, and I will fix it.
President Obama declared a national emergency.
You can't shortchange basic services that we provide to our people.
And now 2016 presidential candidates are starting to weigh in.
The governor of that state acted as though he didn't really care.
Lead poisoning is terrible and terrifying. No amount of exposure is safe. And there's evidence that years after we got it out of paint, gas, and more, it contributed to a drastic drop in crime in the 90s. The city has switched back to cleaner water, but the effects will last decades. We take clean water for granted. How could this possibly happen in 2016? Well, you've got to rewind to 2011. Flint was broke. It had lost about half its population after the car factories closed. It had $1.1 billion in unfunded pension costs. It had to cut half its police force. Michigan had a solution called emergency managers.
Now he's been appointed by the governor to turn around Flint's finances. Mike, welcome.
These managers can make cost-cutting measures without the normal political procedure.
I think what we have to do is look at the expense side first. There could be services that we can no longer provide in the city.
And they decided the city could save money on water. Flint would stop buying water from Detroit and join a new regional water system. And as a temporary measure, Flint would use water from the Flint River. The switch happened in 2014.
Here's to Flint.
And who decided to do this exactly is under intense debate. But regardless of blame, the story gets worse. Residents saw and tasted the dirty water and started complaining.
Water's brown, has a bad odor. I'm afraid to even feed it to my cat or my dogs.
We should not have to pay for the water. It's nasty.
But the city claimed federal tests showed the water was safe. An employee at the Environmental Protection Agency leaked a Michigan report to a local activist, which showed the water had higher than normal lead levels. The city's response? Flint told the woman the lead came from her plumbing. It took an outside investigation by Virginia Tech researchers that found elevated lead levels in the water for the state to admit there was a problem in September 2015.
So the corrosion's eating up the pipes, it's eating up the iron pipes, it's causing main breaks, it's causing discolored water, and about 20% of the homes, there's just too much lead.
In October 2015, the government bought water filters for its citizens and switched back to water from Detroit. Before all this, 2.1% of the city's children had high blood lead levels. After, it was 4%. For kids under 5 in the most affected zip codes, it was 6.3%. Why did Flint poison its citizenry? Under emergency managers from the state, it wanted to save money. To start to reverse the effects will cost dearly. Just switching back to Detroit's water cost $12 million. A class action lawsuit against the city is pending.
Thank you.
Was I unwise to leave them open for so long? As I have wandered through this world, and as each moment has unfurled, I've been waiting to awaken from these dreams. People go just where they will. I never noticed them until I got this feeling that it's later than it seems. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what you see. I hear their cries. Just say if it's too late for me. To